Hello, thank you for downloading this podcast of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. We hope you enjoy listening to this. For more information about our programs, please visit www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.
So good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to 19 Washington Square North, which is the intellectual center and home of NYU Abu Dhabi here in New York. Many of you don't know me. I'm Michael Truganen. I'm a silver professor of biology here in New York. I also run a laboratory at NYU Abu Dhabi, and I am the academic director of 19 Washington Square North. So welcome, everybody, this afternoon. So it's a pleasure to welcome you to another academic year of exciting and stimulating programs here at 19. Over the academic year, 19 Washington Square North is host to many different activities, including lectures, conferences, exhibitions, and their openings. And it also serves as a meeting space for students and faculty and indeed members of the public to interact and to learn. A key partner of ours here at 19 is the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute in New York, which has organized many of the activities here in Washington, here that offers the Washington Square community opportunities to hear experts talk about their research and its societal relevance, technological and cultural impact, and importance for the world at large. I want to acknowledge the work of Sharon Hakakian-Bergman, the director of the academic and research programs of NYU Abu Dhabi Institute, who with her staff puts together many of these activities. So today we're very, very pleased to see all of you at this conversation with Professor Deborah Williams, who is clinical professor of liberal studies at NYU, and for many years, someone who has taught literature at NYU Abu Dhabi. So aside from her faculty work, Deborah is a novelist and literary critic and former columnist for The National, which many of you know as the English language newspaper of the UAE. Her writing has also appeared in other non-academic places, such as the New York Times, the Paris Review, The Rumpus, and Brevity. She writes about culture, art, books, family, the perils of parenthood, feminism, travel, teaching, and learning. Her recent book is The Necessity of Young Adult Fiction, published this year by Oxford, and focuses on the ways that young adult fiction offers imaginative reconceptualizations about identity, nation, and the human relationship to the planet. Today, she will lead us in conversation with two NYU Abu Dhabi alumni on this topic, and I invite her up here to introduce both the topic and her co-panelists. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Michael, for that introduction and for all of you for coming out on such a dreary day. I lived in Abu Dhabi long enough that for a little while I was appreciating all the rain, and now I'm just really tired of it. So I'm a little soggy. I am here today to talk about young adult fiction, which is a topic dear to my heart. And I am with two amazing alumna from NYU Abu Dhabi. And you need to wave when I see your hand. Zoe Patterson is a writer. Who is currently pursuing an MFA in creative nonfiction right here at NYU. She's originally from Toronto, but grew up in Abu Dhabi, and she studied literature and creative writing at NYUAD. Her capstone was a young adult novel called Na'ila, which is about a young woman who moves to El Ain, which is a town sort of outside of Abu Dhabi, and becomes impregnated by a jinn, and complications, as you might imagine, ensue. The novel was inspired by G. Willow Wilson's book, Aleph of the Unseen, and the idea of the love laws from Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things. Zoe is now working on a memoir about childhood, family, and her cosmopolitan upbringing in Abu Dhabi. I can't wait to read it. And my other sort of conversationalist today is Aisha Shafiq, who's originally from Malaysia. Aisha is a second-year student in the creative writing MFA program at Sarah Lawrence, concentrating in speculative fiction. In addition, she also writes poetry and nonfiction. As an undergraduate at NYU Abu Dhabi, she completed her literary studies capstone entitled Embracing the Resistance of Maria Sabina and Her Saint Children, A Journey to the Edges of Eco-Criticism, in which Aisha explored ways to engage with bodies of indigenous knowledge without being extractive or exploitative, which is actually quite complicated. For her master's thesis, Aisha is working on an epic fantasy novel inspired by the mythologies and histories of Southeast Asia, and which explores interspecies and class struggles within a landscape of widespread food precarity. And I asked Aisha and Zoe both to join me here today because they were both students of mine in Abu Dhabi. I was involved, lucky me, in both of their capstone projects, which is part of why teaching there was such a pleasure. And the courses that I taught in Abu Dhabi were sort of the seeds for what became the necessity of young adult fiction. And it's a course, I taught a lot of children's literature when I was teaching in New York at an unnamed, small, conservative Catholic college outside of Manhattan. You can fill in the name yourself. And the students asked me to teach a course on Harry Potter before Rowling had ever finished the series, before she would became sort of more known for her transphobic comments than her literature. And in that context, teaching children's literature was really a rebellion, because it wasn't serious and it was magic and it was banned in a lot of places. And that course, when I came to Abu Dhabi, had to change because it couldn't just be a sort of nice, safe course about Anglo-European children's literature and white kids who encounter magic, right? So things had to change. And both Aisha and Zoe, both in class with me and in conversations with me when they weren't in my direct classes, they helped sort of move us or move my thinking quite widely. And I'm gonna move to the chair now, which is the signal for it to become conversation as opposed to lecture. But a small word about format, which is that often in the nature of these things, you know, the people in the front of the room talk and then there's time for questions. And what we would really like in the honor, in the idea of conversation is that as we are talking, and we have some talking points prepared, but as we are talking, if you have a question, ask it. I mean, raise your hand. There are mics so that we can actually have a conversation and not us talk, then you talk, right? So that we can all kind of get involved in this. So I'm going to sit over here now. I think they're going to lift the screen so that Zoe's not worried about imminent decapitation, and we'll begin. Oh, it's very, is this on? Oh, it's very different over here now. See, it's a whole different vibe, right? Absolutely. But I want to start a little bit with talking about this class because teaching children's literature is a little bit of a weird thing, right? And my book starts actually with a conversation that truly happened. A colleague of mine said, oh, your class is so popular. And I said, yeah, I guess, yeah, whatever. And he said, oh, but it's because you're teaching children's literature. I was like, yes. And the implication was clear, right? Like, it's an easy class. It's not serious. That's why you're doing it. The real smart people, the real professors, They do serious things, right? And one of the things that is tricky about teaching and writing about children's literature is precisely that, right? That it isn't seen as serious in a lot of ways. And as a discipline, if you are teaching children's literature courses, depending on the university or the college, you might be in the education department, right? You might be even in library studies because children's literature is about literacy or curriculum. You might be in the literature or the English department, as they call it here. You're probably not. Both Aisha and Zoe will report that if you're doing an MFA, there isn't an MFA in children's literature. It's not, you know, it's not serious, right? And one of the things that we started talking about, Zoe and Aisha and I, is the very idea of young adult literature, right? When Harry Potter was super popular, grown-ups walked around with their Harry Potter book, right? And it was sort of okay. But it's also, it's something that if you read children's literature as a grown-up, you might feel a little bit like you might not carry it cover out on the subway. You might keep it like in your bag. You might read it only at home because it's not, you know, it's not serious, right? And what we're here to say, it is serious. Spoiler, that's the point. It is serious. But we're also here to start, I think, with the very idea of
what does it mean to do young adult fiction? What is it?
Is it, some might say it's the most universal
fiction there is, because we've all been, like it or not, we've all been young adults.
But we haven't all been,
say, detectives,
right? We haven't all been maybe
in a torrid romance. Maybe we have, but maybe we haven't,
right?
We haven't all been in spaceships or magical worlds. Sadly,
we're in this one, right? So there's a way in which young adult fiction is actually for all of us.
But what does that really mean? Do we need that rubric anymore? Is it so general that
it doesn't matter?
Because young adult fiction is
horror. Young adult fiction is
speculative. Young adult fiction is
John Green, very realistic,
sort of contemporary issues. Young adult fiction is mysteries. Young adult fiction is
kind of everything. So maybe we don't need that rubric anymore. Right? But so what I want to start with, and people can jump in as they want, but I want to ask Aisha and Zoe first is, you know, what is young adult fiction? What is it doing? Do we need that rubric? What did it, as it were, what did it do for you when you were reading it, when you do read it? Can we start with that?
Sure. There are enough mics to go around. Okay, there's also one right in front of you.
Oh, that's...
You can have two if you want.
I think for me as a child, and we talked about this earlier, there was, in my bookstore, there was my hometown's bookstore. There was a children's section, and then there was a young adult section that encircled it, and then the rest of the store was adult fiction. So as a kid, I really enjoyed going into that little nook and knowing that anything that I found there was probably going to be interesting to me and exciting. And I used to just come with like this big pile of books and try to convince my mom to let me buy 10 of them, and she'd get two. So I think we were talking about the difficulty of like deciding what counts as young adult or children's literature. But I think for kids, it's important to have that distinction. But then when you're an adult, it kind of tells you, at least to me, it's kind of signaled, you're not supposed to read this. And if you write this, a lot of people said when I was writing my capstone, oh, that's so cute. I was like, my work is cute. So we were also talking about how it's kind of a feminized area, and that anything that women do is just, you know, cute and irrelevant. I've taught them more.
Yeah, I think, there where you talk about this in your book, about the difficulty of defining YA, because YA, the category itself pertains to both the content and the audience. You know, people often define it or think of YA because it contains a protagonist or a cast of characters that are between the age of 12 and 18, but that can easily apply to the age of the readership. And so I think, although both of those categories obviously are always in flux, especially in terms of readership that we've mentioned, that adults also read it. And I think it's, you know, our point that we want to get across is that adults should be reading and should be paying attention to young adult fiction.
One of the things when this book came out, one of the reviewers said that it would be more apt to call it speculative fiction, because the writers that I
talk about in this book are all writing, we'll call it speculative fiction. Maybe it's sci-fi, maybe it's
a little fantasy. There, Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower is in this book.
G. Willow Wilson's Aleph the Unseen, which is set in an unnamed emirate and draws on everything from, the Thousand and One Nights to Star Wars. What else is in this book? The Golden Compass is mentioned a few times.
Some terrific books set in the what used to be
we would know it as the American Southwest, written by a woman who is Navajo
and African American, and it becomes like Mad Max in the aftermath of a huge flood that's rebuilt or reconstructed the American United States. And the idea of thinking about speculative fiction and YA fiction is a kind of double whammy of what we might think of as genre fiction, right? And historically, genre fiction, detective fiction, speculative fiction, science fiction, romance novels, gets sort of pushed aside. It's not serious literature. Serious literature is what Jonathan Franzen wants to think that he is when he grows up. Serious literature is, I don't know, we all have, you know, serious literature is big, important books. How many of you, be honest, read Richard Powers' book, The Overstory? Okay, that's one. How many of you heard about Richard Powers' book, The Overstory? How many of you know how long Richard Powers' book, The Overstory, is? Naomi, that's good. It's your 500 pages. How many of you have read Kim Stanley Robinson's Ministry for the Future? One of the key fictional accounts of sort of climate fiction or eco-fiction. 500 plus. These are serious books, grown-up books. They get reviewed in all the important places. And they are, I guess you could call them speculative. Richard Powers' book is about trees, mostly. And it's beautiful, and you should read it the next time you have time to read a 500-page novel, right? Speculative fiction for YA addresses all of these same issues in ways that you might actually read them. And I am not enough, I'm going to say, if you read it, that's a good thing. That's the thing that matters, because it sets in mind the conversations that need to happen about, let's call it, in this case, climate, responsibility, changing our systems, thinking about personal agency in the face of huge, perhaps insurmountable changes, right? So the question that Zoe and Aisha and I have been thinking a lot about is the role that speculative fiction and genre fiction and YA fiction can play in bringing readers into a conversation that can give them maybe some tools to think about how to deal with these issues. All right, Niobe, do you have a question?
Yeah, I just have a question.
Do you want to use it? Can you either speak louder? Or can
it's linked to your comment, but also your.
When you said I was drawn to that section of the bookstore. And so I'm thinking about, so at this, because I'm an old person, Deborah and I are both old, is that I am now only drawn to fiction that has strong female characters where the story is not about their heterosexual relationship with a man. Like, I'm not drawn to those stories anymore. I'm only drawn to something that helps me figure something out about myself that's expansive, but that's also good literature. And so I'm curious about, from the young adult fiction, what, and I'm curious from both of you actually, what pulls you story-wise? And so, I mean, does that make sense? Like, story-wise, to those, what stories are they telling you that you're yearning for that it satisfies? And I think that's what.
I think for me, my draw to young adult fiction from the beginning and even until now is that a lot of these stories are concerned with giving young people agency, which, as young people entering this world in which there's so many compounding structural issues that we've sort of just inherited by virtue of being born at this time, I think we're looking for not just ways to exercise agency, but that we do have agency. And a lot of these stories, I think that was the importance of young adult fiction to me growing up, was that they were this refuge in the sense that I, had some control over my life. And I think that was also the pull to these more sort of genre stories like science fiction or fantasy, in which it's sort of written in a quest format, or these people or these characters who are really trying to find their way in a world that is stacked against them. So that's something that I found in young adult reading that I take into my work right now, and I'm still continuing to explore. you know, I was really struck. I've been reading in my program stories by Edward P. Jones, the writer from Washington, who, and, you know, I think a lot about sort of the political effect of writing. And he's not in a, he's not what would be considered an overtly political writer. And his writer's more concerned about, his writing is more concerned about the interiority of people's lives. And reading a review of that, the importance of looking at these, in looking at the importance he gives to portraying people's lives in such detail, is to remember that structural issues are not completely impersonal. Like racism, capitalism, colonialism, all these injustices and acts of unkindness are being carried out by people. So that's just some sort of thinking that I've synthesized, but definitely this question of agency is definitely something I found in young adult literature and in genre fiction. Zoe?
Yeah, I love what you said about agency. And I think like, being drawn to writing young adult fiction also, I feel, or I think I can, I think I can trick people into reading my ideas. So if I have a really fun, exciting fantasy story, then I can embed cosmopolitanism or eco-criticism or feminism. And that genre was where I discovered those ideas. So I know that they can be implanted in the minds of the youth. in that way. I don't think I was looking for those messages. I think I was looking for an escape and a fun story to read. And I think this will get into something else that we've been talking about a lot, which is to me, like as a teenager and even now, good prose doesn't necessarily mean what other people thinks it means. So to me, good prose is easy to read and it's quick and it's digestible and it's punchy. And I think when things are too easy to read, people think that they're not intellectual.
I think this question about story and wanting to find, you know, to use your example, Niobe, of, you know, strong female characters who aren't necessarily searching for a heterosexual romance in all of the, and it's, you know, I guess, you know, this is my filter, but in the books that I'm talking about in my book, the novels I'm talking about in this book, the female characters, they almost all are female lead characters. There is romance, but that is not the raison d'etre. All of these books would pass, what is it, the Bechdel test, right? They are women talking to women about things other than men, and they have names, right, of their own. And they are all this idea of finding and looking for agency. And I'm thinking about the work of Aisha's and Zoe's that I've read, in which there are women characters, female characters, who are looking for ways to find, you know, we talk about finding voice and giving people their voice. And one of the things we forget is that for lots and lots of people in the world, first you have to be told that you have a voice before you can find your voice and express your voice and use your voice. First, you have to learn that you actually have a consciousness, you have something worth saying, and then you can figure out how to use it and how to use it effectively or not. I think that one of the things that YA can do, and like everything, you know, there's a lot of bad YA, just like there's a lot of bad fiction, right? There's just a lot of bad writing in the world, a lot of bad movies in the world. I offer to you Adam Sandler, right? I mean, there, right? So there's a lot that's not great, right? But I think that in a YA novel, one of the things that I appreciate and I think is so important is that they are both about and theoretically designed for people who are on the verge of coming into power. Right? They are potential. If you're from between the ages of 13 and 18, in most countries, you can't vote. You can't hold public office. You can't, in some places, you can't drive. You know, there are lots of things you can't do, but you're learning how to find those things, right? And so these are novels that can show you ways of being in the world that offer you power and transition and creative transitions, which is why it can be really satisfying to read as an older person, herself in transition, you know, because these are people who are on a threshold, right? And that threshold might change depending, but there's a threshold, right? I think I'm going to just finish this one thought. Thank you. One second. I think that it is really interesting to watch in the guise of, oh, it's a rip-roaring romp through, you know, some pretend country that you don't know about, and look, the mushrooms are talking, and look, they're cute little creatures, and it's all very fantastical. And then realize that what you have when you finish is like, wow, nobody there was afraid of people who are different from them. That's cool. Wow, I maybe don't have to kill the animals. I could maybe just exist with the animals. Or, wow, maybe I don't have to exist at the top of a resource pyramid. Maybe I could just be horizontal in my way of thinking about the universe, right? And so Philip Pullman, who wrote The Golden Compass, and I can't remember any of the others, Subtle Knife and... That's, thank you very much. He has a comment about writing for children where he says the thing about having a younger audience is, he says something like, they don't have time for your razzle dazzle and your fancy prose. They want plot. They want things to happen. They want characters they can understand. They want to connect. And then, so they're a really demanding readership, right? And if any of you have tried to tell a young child a good night story, like, well, that can't happen that way. Neither now. That's not, uh-uh. And you're like, oh my God, it's pretend. That's not how the pretend works, yeah. Right? So there's real rigor there. And as also, I had my students just, I was telling you this, just earlier last week, we were talking about the need for simplicity and why writing simple and writing clear is really, really hard. And they were like, meh, meh, meh. And I said, well, just then fine. Write down how to tie a shoe lace. And they kind of looked and they all started to make little hand gestures, you know, and your bunny ears and the thing. And thing. Like, no, just write it down. And they, oh, it's really hard. Yes, right. So to your question, I think that YA, in the guise of giving us great plots or interesting characters and strong female characters, not the same as likable, right? But it can do a lot of other things, right? You had a question.
Thank you, Michael.
We have another one. Look at that. Oh, wait, we have a third. We have microphones. It's magic room.
Can you guys hear me? Yes. Thank you guys for being here today. It's really interesting to hear all of your perspectives, and I just wanted to pick up on something that you were saying about thresholds. I'm on the other side of kind of what you guys do. I work in publishing. So I've worked at Simon & Schuster, Scholastic, and most recently HarperCollins. And I'm in marketing. So a lot of what we talk about is audience. And obviously as someone who used to be a young adult person and who also did the NYU Masters of Publishing program and graduated 4 years ago now, which is scary. We talked a lot about how in my children's publishing classes, how when you are young and you are interested in reading YA, there's a distinction between people who are interested in reading YA that identify as female and that identify as male. Mm. And that tapers off around age 12 for people who identify as male. And obviously I don't know you three very well. I am at this panel today. And I don't know how you identify it personally. But I was wondering if you could kind of speak to, if you have any like inferences as to why that kind of tapers off and why at age 12 and up, people who identify as male kind of tend to go for like more adult, whatever that means. I have my own answers, obviously, but I wanted to hear your perspective.
I do, but you want to start? You have a teenage brother?
I do, yeah.
This one?
Yeah, my brother is 17 and he doesn't read. And I think part of his frustration with a lot of the books that I found really exciting was he was like, these are girl books. They're about girls. And he's not going to read The Hunger Games or Divergent or any of the other books that are eluding me that have female protagonists. Because I think as girls, and Deborah writes about this in her book, we are taught how to imagine what it would be like to be a boy. So we read Harry Potter and we're like, it doesn't matter that he's a boy. It's an interesting story. But I think something happens to boys where
they're not.
Patriarchy intervenes at some point and tells them that they're not allowed to like girl things or to empathize with girls in the same way. And I think because children's and young adult literature is so feminized, we have a lot of female authors, women authors, who want to write our own stories and who want to write for our younger selves in some way. So we don't write male characters as much, maybe.
This is on. I see you in the back, just one second. I think, you know, that is there was a woman who wrote a really interesting article in the early days of Harry Potter about exactly that girls read Harry Potter and didn't mind identifying with Harry, even though they all were also, you know, they were all also Hermione's. I mean, we were both, right? We could sort of code shift in that way. But boys aren't taught to code shift in that way. And interestingly, and maybe it's because I'm an old, and my sons, one of them read The Hunger Games with Katniss Everdeen because she kills people. I mean, right? It was like violent and exciting and their weapons and chase and, you know, there's a lot of plot, right? And so they all passed around, the boys in my son's grade all passed around The Hunger Games and sort of devoured them. I thought they were great, right? I'm not entirely sure they noticed that Katniss was a girl. So the reading comprehension there is a little sketchy, but whatever. So there was that. And I think it's really interesting. I was just reading about this today. Who was it? An interview with Caitlin Moran, who said that, you know, a lot of boys who've been born in the last sort of 15 years or so have grown up in this kind of girl power zeitgeist. And while those of us who are older know that that girl power zeitgeist is A, really new, and B, veneer thin, they've grown up in a world where the sort of public narrative is girls can do anything. And so then these boys are like, well, how come I got to read all these books about girls? Girls can do anything. We know that. It's fine. And that changes. But I wonder if that's part of it, right? And when I try to think about male writers of young adult fiction that sort of hit big, there's John Green.
Rick Riordan.
Oh, Rick Riordan. Okay. And then I kind of stop. There's the Goosebumps guy. R.L. Stein, right? Who's never had a book on the New York Times bestseller list ever and has made more money than anybody, right? So it's an interesting question, I think, this question of gender and readership. It is also the case that YA and that readership makes more money for publishing than almost any other sector, except like the Bible, right? It's such a huge portion of the publishing industry. Right. Aisha, did you want to add to this?
Yeah, so one of the things that we talked about previously, the three of us, is how rarely YA is taught in schools for students. And, you know, I think schools or the home is definitely a place where your reading culture begins. And, you know, I wonder, and I don't really have an answer, and this isn't really an answer, I wonder if one of the reasons why young boys or young male teens have a harder time empathizing or putting themselves into the shoes of female characters is just this sort of absence or lack in the way that we're taught to read, that we shouldn't be identifying with people who aren't like us, which I think has definitely persisted into our wider reading culture, even as we grow older. You know, being afraid of reading about people who aren't like us. And so I think that could possibly also be part of why, you know, even from a young age, it's important from a young age to be taught and to be encouraged to read widely the experiences of other people who aren't like you. And that can be across, you know, the spectrum of gender and sexuality and race and ethnicity and nationality. Yeah.
We'll come back to the idea of being a good reader, but Aisha also just pegged why YA fiction is banned more than any other kind of book. It's just that whole reading things that are different. But there was a question in the back. Yeah.
Hi. Reflecting on the publishing industry and gender readership, you are describing YA as this like discovering you have agency. And it's accessible and people like stories of coming into power. And then also speaking of like the authorship is very gendered. We're especially seeing women and people of minority getting pushed into turning these stories that they have into YA books, often by publishers. And so there is this sort of creating the gendered space in YA, you know, authorship that then sort of ties into who's reading these books. I was wondering if you have any reflections on, like, you're saying that these stories are important to be read and accepted by everyone. Is that something that should come into, like, sort of exploding out this YA category, making it as important as it is to study and celebrate YA books, at the same time, like making more space for these stories to not be YA, and how would that then affect gender of readership?
That's a super easy question. That's a really great question. And one of the things we were talking about, we had a sort of conversation, is whether, you know, maybe we don't need the category young adult literature anymore, and it should just be books, right? Or, you know, books about spaceships and books about, you know, sex and books about animals and however you do it. And that had been sort of my impetus, right? Oddly, for a woman who just wrote a book called The Necessity of Young Adult Fiction, I wrote an article for a paper in the UK saying we should do away with YA, which seems a little counterintuitive, right? But then that's when Zoe said, well, but the thing is, then I'm a 14-year-old kid and I go into the bookstore, I might not know where to go. And maybe I need that space. And so that's a tricky question. You know, not everything needs to be a YA book. And in some cases, I think, unfortunately, that often means kind of maybe people think it needs to be simplified or watered down or something. On the other hand, I don't know, right? So that's my real answer is I'm not sure what the answer is. Because I think there is a need for that space and a kind of preserving of that space. And at the same time, I think it would be really, really great if more grownups read some of what's happening in YA, because it's some of the most interesting and experimental and unusual and creative fiction going at the moment. What do you think?
You know, listening to your question, it also just made me think about the industry and the market and how the buying trends. It seemed to me as if the implication of what you were saying is that, you know, in order to sell one's stories, publishers, because of how lucrative YA fiction is compared to perhaps other genres or other categories, publishers are wanting artists and writers to alter their stories and tell them in a certain format just so they could sell. And that, you know, that's definitely a problem, because, you know, I'm really of the firm belief that an artist should be able to tell the stories on their own terms and not have to think about, you know, what will sell and what the audience wants. I think that can get in the way of one's process. But there's also the reality that a lot of writers do this and have to make money and have to make income. And so there's this conflict. And I think it's definitely on the industry to also answer to this. And also on audience to like shift demand. But I think it is, you know, it is the responsibility of publishers to allow writers from marginalized communities to tell the stories that they want to and really not care about how much money they're going to make, because you know that's part of marketing and publicity, and they can do that.
So we got paid. So one of the things that's really interesting and what I love about some of the books that I write about is how many of them are trying to imagine a world that is outside of capitalist structures and also that's outside of nationalism, right? So that in most of the books that I write about, national identity as a marker is no longer matters. And when you take away that marker, it starts to do something different about how you encounter people, about how you think about their stories, about their identity. And it, you know, it kind of loops back around to, you know, the sort of marketing push of hashtag own voices, right? And movements like that have helped create or have called attention to the lack of diversity in the publishing world, both in terms of the people who make the marketing decisions and the sort of capital, the business decisions, and the writers themselves, right? It is interesting to me that if you think about scholarship in children's literature or YA literature, so my book deals almost exclusively, with the exception of the sort of ubiquitous and omnipresent J.K. Rowling, non-white writers. There's a woman named Ebony Elizabeth Thomas who has a great book called The Dark Fantastic, which is about race in children's literature. And there are individual articles, but there's very few critical studies done about race and diversity in children's literature. It's the thing that doesn't get talked about, right? It just kind of skates along. And I see a question in the back. So maybe we can have that question, and I want to come back then to the idea of being a reader, right?
I was just kind of curious, has the self-publishing, like online market, able to kind of bring more diversity in voices to the literature, to the market?
That's a really good question, and I don't have a lot of statistics about that at my fingertips. I will say that in terms of... this is a terrible expression, I'm sorry. In terms of moving the needle, as if you self-publish, it's really, really hard to register, right? So you can self-publish, and if obviously people do, and there are stories of people who self-publish and sell, you know, tens of thousands of books and they make a bunch of money and it's great, but that's very rare. And so for a mainstream publisher to pay attention to a self-published, particularly YA book, I don't have any examples of that in my head. I don't know if anybody else does. I can't really think of any, right? But I want to, so maybe there are two ways we could go, but maybe in terms of thinking about writing and diversity, maybe we could ask, I could ask Aisha and Zoe to each speak a little bit about their MFA programs as a launch pad for the writers of tomorrow in terms of diversity and different stories and so forth. I'm thinking about that girl in the suburbs.
can you get that to Aisha?
Yeah, so quickly on the MFA, just looping it back into like what sells in publishing and then what people think is important and good work. Aisha and I both struggled to find MFAs in children's literature. And I think yours is the only one I've seen that's in speculative fiction. And I ended up doing, excuse me, I ended up doing creative nonfiction because I wanted to, but also because I couldn't quite find the right program for the kind of fiction that I wanted to write. And I didn't want to write realist fiction. So I just wasn't interested in that. And I think this idea of realist fiction being the most important type combined with a lack of diversity in the program means that I was sitting down with another international friend and she said, everyone is writing a coming of age story about the suburbs. And she's like, I feel like I keep reading the same story over and over again. And I think that that's a huge problem. And looking around the room at my program, I was like, everyone, not everyone, maybe 85, 90% of people look exactly like me and they're middle-class white women. So obviously I think that's a huge difficulty and a problem in the MFA world in general, a certain type of story is being told and upheld as being important.
Yeah, I think sort of a counterexample to that, we talk about a little bit about how in our pre-conversation, there is this unwillingness to, you know, for what we have been advocating for good reading from both the right and the left. And I want to give an example from, you know, my program. It's really wonderful that they have a speculative genre, speculative fiction track. That's why I applied there. But there are also not that many people of color, especially not people of color who aren't American. And I was in a class where there were a few of us in a workshop of like 12 or 13. And it was really wonderful having their eyes workshopping my work because they were bringing in experiences that I had and that perhaps the other students didn't have into the reading, and that informed me of what kind, you know, it was valuable perspectives to have. But also I was noticing there was this culture about thinking that our white American classmates couldn't understand us and thus weren't equipped to read our stories. Almost looking down on their stories. And I don't support that either. I do think there's been this reaction because, and it's come out of a valid place of feeling like we aren't represented in the stories. And I can say when I first started writing my novel, back when I was 17, it was a completely different story, but it took me like a long time to realize that all my characters were white because I had totally internalized sort of Eurocentric conventions of fantasy and sci-fi, and I didn't like see a problem with that. So it's come out of a good place where we feel like we have and we're not in the stories that we want to read. But that fear and that anger, I think, is also bolstering this idea that I think it's creating an environment where people are less compassionate with each other, less open to the fact that we have more similarities than we are giving each other the chance to discover. In Deborah's book, she talks about how being a good reader is finding resonances in the experiences of people who might not necessarily look like you or have different experiences. What fiction is for is to find connection and, you know, to see that despite our difference, we share similar griefs. For people who are more interested in this, Zadie Smith has this brilliant essay called Fascinated to Presume, a Defense of Fiction, that I, you know, really articulated so many of my feelings about this. And I've been in classes in college where It felt like I was a traitor if I voiced any of these concerns. And so I think the MFA space is like fraught with a lot of questions about how to be a good reader. And, you know, even when there are people in the room that quote unquote are diverse, there are still issues that we have to deal with and talk about. Yeah.
Bad news to the audience, since I know Deborah, I have all these ideas I want to engage. I'm a developmental psychologist. I write about social emotional development of teenagers, and I write primarily about boys of color, and I've been doing this since the late 80s. So I've been representing boys of color in what they teach me about humans. And what's amazing to me is that my primary readership at this point is white families with white sons reading stories about boys of color talking about friendships. So to me, I really feel strongly that one of the problems is that the assumptions we make that, right, that people will actually, if you provide it, they'll actually pull it, you know, be pulled in when it's around a topic, for example, like friendships, real friendships or something. So to me, it's a problem in part of thinking that white people will only be drawn to white characters, and therefore we have to, right, and people of color will only be drawn to people of color. I mean, it's just such a simplistic notion, and I get it. The diversity is, that's the point. But why not reimagine that, like, you could be writing a character about a kid from wherever, and who would have thought some boys at a prep school flying on a broom would, you know, would be something that would be super popular among adults too. So I just think at some level we have to like push beyond this. I mean, I know you're saying that, but I just think it's interesting to me that we also assume white people are only interested in white characters. And that's just not the case when you provide a good story. Yeah.
So one of the things I talk about everywhere, basically, but in this book in particular, is that all of the novels that I'm writing about, and I think you can find it in a lot of YA fiction in particular, is that over and over again in all of these books, which on the surface look very, very different, right? So there's Akata Witch, which is set in contemporary Nigeria, and there's Parable of the Sower, which was written in the early 90s and is set in what used to be LA, and then there's Harry Potter, and then there's Aleph the Unseen. Over and over and over again, characters have to learn to be good readers. They have to learn how to, and the characters who fail to become good readers, the characters who believe just one story, or who think there's only one truth, or there's only one legend, those characters are either dangerous or they die. Right? I mean, the stakes are pretty high. And to become, not to be too fine a point, but the idea over and over again in these novels, and part of what I really appreciate them for, is that they are showing characters, and maybe they're not reading books, maybe they are listening to folktales, maybe they are digging through, in one case, in Trail of Lightning, which is this Rebecca Roanhorse sort of set in the American Southwest. She's looking through an old library that's been left over after these floods and trying to read the various remnants that have been left behind. Or they're looking at, in Aleph the Unseen, there's the 1001 Nights, the book we all know, but then there's a djinn-authored version called the 1001 Days, right? And so the character has to learn how to read both of these. So this idea of learning how to read in a way that is about holding multiplicity, about holding ambiguity, there might not be an answer, about reading stories that are maybe not your stories, right? And kind of crossing over and finding that connection. My Cyrus Patel and I are just finishing this giant literary history in which we talk a lot about something we call a cosmopolitan reading practice. And to be a cosmopolitan, on the one hand, is a really lo-fi, low-tech thing. It means have a conversation with people who aren't like you. Like, you don't need software, you don't need an app. It's just like talk, right? But the idea behind cosmopolitanism, or underpinning it, is that difference is an opportunity and not a threat. And so over and over and over again in these novels and in YA fiction, and it's one of the things that speculative fiction can teach us, is this idea that you can encounter like a weird, squidgy, splooge thing and just talk to it. You don't have to kill it or run away from it, or you might run away, but then you come back and then you talk to it. And you might look at a story that isn't about your family or your people and think, oh, there's something in there I can connect to. And it's not that we're going to erase the differences. This isn't like everybody hold hands and sing Kumbaya, we're all the same. It's we can find those points of connection and we can be different. And that's going to be okay. We can move from that. And one of the great sort of ironies, and I had to sort of wrestle with this when I was writing the book, and you and I, we've all talked about this, is that over and over again in Harry Potter, those books are about reading. They're about learning to read. They're about becoming good readers. They're about what a bad book can do to you, right? Think, if you go back, if you've read Harry Potter, think about how many books in that series kill you, attack you, steal your soul, imprison you. There's a book that's a monster that like chases Harry under the bed or hides under the bed and then comes out and chases her. But over and over and over again, it's about the danger of reading. And it's also a whole series about the danger of fundamentalism, right? Which is, fundamentalism is one story. MAGA is one story. Taliban is one story. Authoritarianism is one story. That's dangerous. And it's part of why I think people felt so betrayed when J.K. Rowling, in her comments about trans women and trans people, just had one story. Like she, it was as if she hadn't read her own books. It's just like, never mind all that. And so in the most recent iteration of the children's literature course I taught, I, with great trepidation, because you kind of can't talk about children's literature without talking about Harry Potter, right? I mean, he's like, it's just the ghost in the machine. So I put some Harry Potter books on the syllabus, and I was really worried that the students were going to scream at me or get mad at me, or, you know, I was afraid. And so we had this whole talk, right? Because think about, and it's one of these things when you think about YA literature and you think, you know, oh, that's for kids, that's not sophisticated, blah, blah, blah. And the students' responses to thinking about Rowling and her sort of public comments and then these books were so sophisticated and so nuanced and so smart that it was just one of those moments where I just really learned something from them, right? And I think that what is intriguing to me is when I was teaching in NYU-UW, so many of the students come from somewhere else, right? Everybody there comes from somewhere else. So I had a class of, I don't know, 18 people. None of them was from the same country. And they had encountered Harry Potter, some of them, in like, it was banned in their country, so they read it like Xerox copies, you know, like Santa that stuff, right? And, or they read it in their mommy, daughter, Czechoslovakian, or, you know, Serbian reading group, and they read it that way. And then other people read it only to improve their English, and then other people had only ever seen the movies, and then other people, you know, so there are all these different versions of it. But over and over and over again, what they came to was that it gave them a place that was different from anywhere else they had in their worlds, that the Harry world gave them something, right? And the students who I've talked about this with in the States, who grew up in the States, say basically, no, we cancel J.K. Rowling. We don't buy Harry Potter anymore. We don't watch her movie. We don't watch the movies. She's done. And it's interesting to me, and this is a little bit of a hypothetical, the students who I encountered in Abu Dhabi who had grown up in countries with a very robust authoritarian censoring government did not want to cancel Rowling and did not want to not read the books. The students who grew up in the United States, which is, you know, got some issues with banning and censoring, were like, no, we're going to cancel it. And I just thought that was really interesting, right? The students who had this sort of censoring experience in their own lives didn't want to censor Rowling, and the students who had grown up without any experience of that, like, yeah, we're just going to cancel it. And I have a comment from a student that I just want to read because I really liked the way he resolved this issue. We were talking about it, and he says, what did he say? Rowling is like my super religious aunt. I love my aunt, but her views about gay people are terrible. He grew up, I think he's from Colombia. So her views about gay people are terrible. And if she knew I was gay, it would be really bad. But she's old and I love my family. So,
and he kind of shrugged. So he's like, and another student chimed in and said, I am who I am because of Rowling, but now I have to stop listening to her. And I just listened to the books. And so it's like, crazy Aunt Jo can like go off, but we're just not going to listen to her anymore. Right. And so I just want to kind of offer that because these are these students, these readers who people think, oh, they're just kids, but they've been able to sort of separate the art from the artist. They see the problems. They've made their peace with it.
They see, but it's also this idea that YA fiction
can really offer people
a home in a way that they might not have anywhere else in the world. And maybe that, to go back to the question of what do we do, do we need still YA? And maybe that's why we still need it, is it offers people this home, this space. Right. That was kind of a tirade. I'm really sorry. Do you want to add to anything to that?
Lindsay and then Stephanie. I could actually get up, couldn't I?
Hi, thanks so much for this. And I'm thinking of it from a parent's perspective. Mm. And I have twin daughters that are right in the process of between children's and YA. And so I have kind of three questions that I'll keep kind of short. One, it's at some point, it seems like you're kind of using children's and YA kind of in tandem. And I'm wondering, do you make those distinctions? The second question is thinking about, you know, the transformation that these books do for these children as they grow. And while all of us throughout our lives are affected by books, you can see the brain development and how these books are really affecting the way that they see the world. And I'm curious, as you are growing out of that kind of age range, and so your brains are fully developed and you're getting further and further away from remembering that kind of concreteness and the way that the magical and those defined rules, are you trying to keep accessing where these young people's minds are at and being able to, or do you say, okay, well, no, this is my voice, and then the young people can take with it what they want? So that's a question. And the last one is about graphic novels.
Oh yeah.
Which is this huge change and many teachers chagrin, you know, about this, and others that say, no, it's great. And I'm curious if you feel that pull and that kind of constraint to somehow make graphic novels, which I think often we as parents allow children to read these books, which are oftentimes more mature than they're ready for, but because they're graphic novels, somehow we think that it's not going to have these mature themes. So just three questions.
I'm thinking of a book that we studied in one of Deborah's classes called Persepolis. Mm. And how it's taught, I read it, it's taught in like to young kids, to like eighth graders. And that book horrified me, like when I was reading in university. I agree that graphic novels are in this weird kind of gray zone where you don't, and maybe that's what I'm worried will happen to YA if we just abolish the genre, because how will kids know? For example, The God of Small Things is about two kids, but I would never suggest that a child should read it. That kind of brings up that concern. And then to answer an earlier question, as a writer writing for young people, who's no longer really in that time in my life anymore, I try to access young people and understand. My brother is just a wealth of anecdotes and frustrations. I hope that answers.
I think the difference between, you're right, I have been going back and forth with children's and YA, and that's not accurate, right? Because I think there is, and if you've had kids, you know there's this moment where children's books, sort of even advanced chapter books, as they're known in the parlance, don't satisfy anymore, right? And so there is this jump, and trying to find those books that ride that space. And I've got to tell you, Harry Potter is really useful in that regard. And there is a Harry Potter somewhere around book four where it's like, oh yeah, no, this is no longer, we're not going to read this before bed anymore because people are going to die. We're going to just, right? Kate DiCamillo does that too. You're like, oh, here's a fun story about a bunny. Oh shit, he's lost at sea. Oh, wait, hold on. So there is something there. But I also think that there is, and I think you probably agree, is that, you know, kids do dark, and trying to give them books that don't allow for that space, I think are doing them a disservice. So you're right. I think there is something between why there is a difference between children and YA, and I'm not sure I can define it, but like porn, I know it when I see it. Right. I think graphic novels are great. I think they can be amazing. And I think that they are often exactly Persepolis, which is about, you know, the Iranian Revolution. So yeah, that's great. You know, if you're 10, it's awesome. But there's also American Born Chinese and Boxers and Saints, which are these amazing books. American Born Chinese is about moving to a new city and to a new school, but it's also about being Chinese and being an immigrant. And it's also layered in with the legend of the Monkey King. And it is a YA, and it's great. And the author, whose name, Gary Liu, L-I-U, I think. Also has a book. No, that's sorry. Thank you. He also has a book called Boxers and Saints. It's a 2-book set, which is amazing. It's about the Boxer Revolution in China. And one story is from the point of view of the boxers who are rebelling, right? And then from the saints is from a Christian convert, and the stories converge, but they are separate, but they are told in, back to back. You can read either one first, and they're graphic novels. And I think graphic novels can do a lot, but I think it is also something that in a classroom is really, it's really useful, again, going to being a good reader, to say to your students or to your kids or whomever, what is this doing that just words can't do? What does the picture add here, right? So that you learn to read that what's happening on the page, yeah? Stephanie had a question.
Well, I was just, thank you also for today. It's a great conversation. And I live in the world of early childhood, elementary ed. I studied elementary ed and went on to work with that age group. And if you are around kids, you know the difference between they love Elephant and Piggy. Like, there's certain things that work. And kids can recognize it anywhere. And there's so many more books that suck that children have to live through because someone wrote them and people buy them. So my curiosity was around who's actually selling young adult fiction, who's actually buying it, and who's really reading it versus these really excellent conversations. And just a little bit about dystopia, like it's out there. COVID has happened. The fascination with so much violence and everything. Sure, kids are not immune for that reality, but also there's supposed to be a promise of being 12 to 18 as sort of a measured entry into some of these worlds. And so that protective mom side is like, wait, I'm not sure I want my 12-year-old reading the same things that a 42-year-old is still getting a lot out of because YA is interesting. Those are very different categories.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really interesting question. Do you guys want to tackle?
Okay, that's not entirely fair. I go back to Adam Sandler. I think there's just a really lot of bad stuff out there.
And one of the things that's interesting is that in sales, I was looking to see if I could find the stat, but in sales of YA fiction, particularly, they're huge, but it is increasingly adults are buying the books, and often they're buying them for themselves. And so YA and children's literature both are this really interesting thing. Like they're written for kids by adults, they're bought by adults, they're marketed by adults, so they come in only very late in the game,
right? A long time ago, the actress Ally Sheedy, I don't know if you guys know this, she was the Breakfast Club. Ally Sheedy wrote a book called She Was Nice to Mice, and she, which I loved, which is about a Queen Elizabeth from the view of a mouse who lived like in her hoop skirts. And Ally Sheedy published it. She was 13, something like that. And I always thought that was kind of a miracle. And it was only much later when I was grown up that it was because her mom was an editor at the publishing house. Right.
And I spent like all of my growing up, like, Ally Sheedy published a book at 13. Why can't I? Like,
my parents are not in publishing. Parents don't, yeah, they're useless to me. So it's really interesting, right? That grown-ups are doing all the decision-making for these books that are for people who aren't grown-ups, which is, right? And I think thinking about what kids like, they, it goes back to Philip Pullman, like kids are really good at calling you on your bullshit, excuse my French, right? They know that this is a stupid book. They know this book is trying to teach me something, right? Because there's a moral. And they don't know, none of us like to be scolded, right? So they don't want to read it. And it doesn't, and things don't come into schools that are interesting because maybe they're dangerous.
Maybe they're going to be too hard. Maybe they're going to, it's going to be a book about somebody who's queer, or maybe it's going to be a book about somebody who, you know, gets mad at the church that they grew up in, or maybe, right? Because we don't, it's really easy
to say, I'm going to make this world safe for you by not showing, and I'm not saying that's what you're doing.
I think that when I think about banned books, the idea, the impetus, if I try to put on my believing hat, is I want to keep my kids safe. So all of these things that are dangerous, because they're about things that I am uncomfortable with, I'm going to keep away from my kid. And
YA fiction
presents so many things that are dangerous or hard, and so much dystopia. And that even gets kind of tired. Even teenagers are like, oh my God, it's another dystopian book.
Yeah, yada, 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 government dysfunction, yada, 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 climate crisis, yada, yada, yada.
But the really good ones do, I think, offer some avenue, some possibility. And so there's a book that, so it's not about COVID, it's a book called Orleans. Do any of you read Orleans? Do you know this? It's set in New Orleans, in the aftermath of a series of climate disasters, the most innocuous of which was Hurricane Katrina, and then it just goes from there. And then there is
a virus that wipes people out.
And so the city gets sealed off from the rest of the country. But what happens inside Orleans is that if you are of a certain blood type, you're immune to the disease. And so tribalism resurfaces, but it's around blood type, right? I'm AB, I'm O negative, da, 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 da. And so then it's a quest story. You know, you got to get a thing, and it's like a video game. You know, I got to get in, and I got to get a thing, and I got to level up and get the other thing. And then I got to figure out how to get out. And then da, 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 da. So it's a great plot. It's a really interesting premise. And
without giving you any spoilers, I will say that there is hope at the end.
And I think given our time, unless either of you want to, I will end with saying there is hope. So that's what, and so you should all go get a YA book
right now. You can buy my book, except I don't have any here to sell.
But you should all read YA, and you should read it proudly.
Let that YA flag fly.
And I want to thank, first of all, Zoe and Aisha for joining me with the, I so appreciate it.
And I want to thank Michael and Ralph Raymond, who put together this this event, and to you for coming out in the
soggy weather. There are snacks downstairs, though.
So please. So thank you all.
You've been listening to a download from the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. You'll find more information on our website, www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.